America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. 6 minutes past the hour on this beautiful Tuesday. It is Tuesday, isn't it? I have such a hard time keeping track of what day of the week it is. You'd think, you know, working 5 days a week. Anyway, Marjorie Cohen is with us. Marjorie, C-O-H-N.com, her website, M-A-R-J-O-R-I-E. She's the author of Cowboy Republic, her new book, Six Ways the Bush Gang Has Defied the Law. She's also the president of the National Lawyers Guild and a professor of law at the Thomas Jefferson School of Law. Lectures throughout the world on international human rights and U.S. foreign policy. Marjorie Cohen, welcome to the program.
My pleasure, Tom.
Great, in fact, great to have you back again. I'm always so pleased to have you on.
I love being on your show.
Thank you. It's mutual. The Attorney General, Mr. Gonzalez, announced yesterday that he's stepping down, and there's a lot of speculation about who may replace him, and that's sort of a whole different topic, but. Frankly, what I'm concerned about, and I think a lot of us are concerned about this in the context of things like, for example, the impeachment of George W. Bush, is that at the very least, the crimes, and I see two clear categories of crimes, those being crimes against democracy and crimes against democracy / the United States, crimes against the Constitution that Gonzalez has participated in, and then larger, arguably, crimes against humanity, war crimes that Gonzalez has participated in, that there's a possibility that by stepping down, he, like Karl Rove, will avoid being held accountable for these. And I'm just curious about your take on that. As a professor of law, you've had, certainly are familiar with the long sweep of history on these kinds of issues. And what are your thoughts on this?
Well, I don't see his stepping down absolving him or relieving him at all of liability. I mean, say that you work for a company and you engage in embezzlement and then you resign from the company, you've still committed embezzlement.
And no, I agree with that. I'm just concerned about the practical political reality. What's the history there?
It depends on how much backbone the Congress has. That's really what it all comes down to, because although Harry Reid says they're going to continue to investigate Alberto Gonzalez and possible criminal wrongdoing, they're going to quickly be consumed with confirming or not his successor and the 2008 election. And the question is, will they hold his feet to the fire? It may be up to a future attorney general, perhaps in a Democratic administration, to actually prosecute Alberto Gonzalez for war crimes under the U.S. War Crimes Act, which is a federal statute, and for perjury because of his lying during the testimony about the U.S. attorney firing scandal.
And the odds are that of all the names that have been floated, other than Patrick Fitzgerald, it seems pretty unlikely that, and even with him, frankly, I think it's unlikely that any of these people who might replace Gonzalez would be inclined to go after Gonzalez.
Well, I think that that's what Bush is going to try to ensure. Now, I heard a very frightening thing this morning, Tom, and I just hope it's not true, and that is that a possible replacement for Alberto Gonzalez might be Joe Lieberman. Think about that for a minute. Think about all the ramifications of what that would mean. First of all, the Senate will confirm one of its own, no matter who it is. So he would get confirmed. And Joe Lieberman, when he voted to confirm Alberto Gonzalez in February of 2005, and he was very defensive of Gonzalez, of the criticism that Gonzalez was receiving for writing that the new paradigm of the war on terrorism renders quaint some of the provisions of Geneva Conventions. And this is what Lieberman said. I think Judge Gonzalez was being restrained and diplomatic in using the words quaint. Now, Lieberman evidently didn't know that the Nazi lawyers at Nuremberg also called the Geneva Conventions quaint and obsolete. But then the question is, let's assume that the Senate confirms Lieberman, which would be a disaster. He would be the consummate loyal Bushy. Let's assume that he gets confirmed confirmed, then what happens to the very delicate balance in the Senate, which is now a democratically controlled Senate because Lieberman, even though he's an independent, votes with the Democratic caucus, although he doesn't really vote with them, but he's supposed to. Then the question is, what is the procedure in Connecticut for replacing Lieberman? And I did a little bit of research and found a proposed bill from January of 2007. At this point, it appears to me, and this, I did some very quick research, that the governor of the state is empowered to appoint a successor. And
right, that's typically the case.
Yeah, and the governor, I think, is a Republican, if I'm not mistaken. So then this proposed bill would make the process for replacing senators the same as that used to fill vacancies for the office of representatives in Congress, and that would be by means of a Democratic election without undue delay. So the question is, and again, I have not finished, I was just doing this research, I just heard this rumor about Lieberman, did that bill pass? And if it didn't, is it true there's a Republican governor? I think there is, and if that's the case, the balance in the Senate could well tip back toward the Republicans. And if this is the case, and this is what they're thinking, then Karl Rove may not be officially on the payroll, but he's still calling the shots from behind the scenes because it would be brilliant and devastating and hideous, I think,
yeah,
for us.
Jody Rell is the governor.
Jody Rell is a Republican. Yes.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's so many things, and it's interesting because speaking of Alberto Gonzalez as a war criminal, you know, I want to refer people to something I wrote in January of 2005. It's on my website, and it's called The Gonzalez Indictment. It was also published in a book. And, you know, I'm a criminal defense attorney, and I've never written an indictment before, but I have to say I quite enjoyed this. I wrote an indictment indicting Alberto Gonzalez for war crimes and laying out, because of the memos that he commissioned and the way that he advised Bush not to follow the Geneva Conventions, which are part of U.S. law, this common plan to violate the Geneva Conventions and grave breaches of the Geneva Conventions, such as torture, constitute war crimes under the U.S. War Crimes Act.
Yeah, and there are venues beyond the United States for which members of the United States, citizens of any country, can be prosecuted for war crimes. Certainly we saw this with Slobodan Milosevic in the International Criminal Court in The Hague. Michael Ratner, the president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, ccr-ny.org is their website, has engaged the government of Germany to try to prosecute the former Secretary of Defense for war crimes. I'm not sure how far that's gone. We're getting him back on the program to discuss that with him. It's been kind of an ongoing struggle, you know, to get Germany involved in it. But the German Constitution provides for it. Do you see any possibility of a venue outside the United States, like the International Court, or is the fact that the U.S. has withdrawn their participation in that court going to exempt us in some way from this? I mean, what's the international situation?
Well, the Milosevic was tried under the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, which is just limited to that particular struggle. The International Criminal Court, as you know, Bush unsigned, took the signature of the United States off of that. So it would be very difficult. He's also extracted bilateral immunity agreements from 100 countries, basically threatening them with the cutoff of aid if they turned over any U.S. nationals to The Hague. So the International Criminal Court is probably, I mean, there are some instances where it could be used, but probably not. And he's also got an act, the Hague Act, which says that if any U.S. official was turned over to The Hague for trial in the International Criminal Court, we'd go in and take him out by military force. So I really don't think that's a possibility. But the situation you referred to in Germany, where the Center for Constitutional Rights, in conjunction with my organization, the National Lawyers Guild, went to the German federal prosecutor and said, will you bring war crimes charges against these U.S. officials for under principles of universal jurisdiction? And universal jurisdiction is very well enshrined in the laws of many countries, including the United States. In fact, Israel used universal jurisdiction to prosecute Adolf Eichmann for his crimes during the Holocaust, even though they had no direct correlation with Israel, and that's because some crimes are so atrocious and so heinous, they're crimes against all of humanity.
Right. And he was caught outside of Israel as well.
Right, right, exactly. So we went to the German prosecutor, and in 2004, when CCR went to the German prosecutor, he said, well, I'm not going to bring any war crimes charges because under our universal jurisdiction statute at this point, because there's no indication that the United States wouldn't prosecute them. Well, of course, that was absurd, but in the meantime, the Bush and Gonzales and company rammed the Military Commissions Act through Congress, and that actually gives immunity to Bush officials for war crimes. So then we went back to the German prosecutor and said, look, now here's your indication that there's not going to be any prosecution of these people in the United States. And the German prosecutor thought about it for 5 minutes and said, I don't think so. And clearly he got a lot of political pressure from the United States.
Sure. Angela Merkel is our friend, as they say. We're talking with Marjorie Cohen. Marjorie, can you stick around for a couple minutes?
Sure.
Great. We'll have another 5 or 6 minutes here before the end of the hour, because I'd like to ask you, you know, how can we undo some of the damage to the U.S. Constitution and our reputation that has been done by this guy in this administration? 16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program, where smart people get their news. This is Air America Radio.
Marjorie Cohen on the line with us. Marjorie Cohen, C-O-H-N.com, her website, the author of Cowboy Republic, 6 Ways the Bush Gang Has Defied the Law, the president of the National Lawyers Guild, professor at the Thomas Jefferson School of Law. And Marjorie, first of all, the rumor that you were sharing with us this morning that Joe Lieberman might be the guy that they're going to put in to replace Gonzo, I had heard that about 3 hours ago. In fact, we'd been talking about it on the morning show on KPOJ, and it makes absolute perfect sense. It's a genius political move from the Republican point of view. It'll flip the Senate Republican. It will accomplish everything that Bush needs done for the rest of his term, and it'll stop at least at the level of the Senate virtually all these investigations dead in their tracks. And it really concerns me. Also, let me let our listeners know our telephone number, 866-303-2270. And we'll take your calls and thoughts on this in just a moment. And our websites, airamerica.com and tomhartman.com. We talked last week somewhat, Marjorie, about how we can repair the damage of the Bush administration, of the high crimes specifically of George W. Bush and the rewriting of constitutional law, things like, you know, posse comitatus and everything else, specifically the damage that Gonzales has done. How do we recover from this?
Oh, boy, it's a tall order, but I do think, Tom, that our first order of business has to be demanding an end to the occupation. You know, Congress has no more will to end the Iraq War than it did during Vietnam, and it was only 1 year after our troops came home that Congress finally cut the funding for all the support for the South Vietnamese government. Nixon did not veto that bill because he needed insurance against impeachment. There is no substantial support in Congress or among the leading presidential candidates to bring all the troops home and disband the mega bases that Bush has built there. Secondly, we have to demand an end to the targeting of those who dissent against Bush's policies, and that means that Congress has to rescind its amendments to FISA that were rammed through Congress before the Labor Day recess, which takes the decision about wiretapping Americans out of the hands of judges and puts it in the hands of the Attorney General and the Director of National Intelligence. We have to hold Congress's feet to the fire, and that means it. That means being there in the streets when there's an Attorney General being proposed, and make sure that that Attorney General is going to be independent, and if not, scream bloody murder. In addition, if heaven forbid Bush were to get another Supreme Court appointment, if anything happened to, say, Stevens or Ginsburg, make sure that the Senate does not cave, the way the senators were saying, oh, we believe you, Judge Roberts, that you're going to be independent. And that means, how do we do that? Okay, so Congress has to cut the funding for the war and not be defensive and say, well, if Bush vetoes the bill, then we're going to be perceived as not supporting the troops, but turn it around and say, Bush is not supporting the troops by vetoing this bill with timetables. Say no to a war on Iran.
Yeah, it almost seems like it what's going to be needed more aggressively than legislative will is public relations will, the willingness to stand up. I mean, you know, Bush has, Republicans have filibustered a number of pieces of legislation, good and appropriate pieces of legislation, and rather than absolutely raising hell the way that Newt Gingrich would have, the Democrats just said, oh, okay.
I know, like
the Employee Free Choice Act, you know.
Nancy Pelosi lets these votes get to the floor. I mean, the Republicans would never allow that. They would never allow these votes to get to the floor. So we need to email, mail, call, write op-eds and letters, and demonstrate. Get in the streets. We're having a demonstration today in San Diego. Bring the troops home now. And it's up to us. We cannot rely on Congress to do it. And, you know, the court is very iffy at this point. So it's really up to the people.
And I hope our good listeners at KLSD in San Diego, a great station and a valued affiliate, will get out there as well. And Marjorie Cohn, if, God forbid, Joe Lieberman is nominated, what should be our response here? And we just have about a half a minute, I'm sorry.
Overwhelming opposition. We have to just barrage the Senate with calls, with emails, get into the streets, organize, write, educate ourselves, listen to shows like yours, read articles that I and other people write, and just make sure that that does not happen. It would be an unmitigated disaster.
Mostly because it would flip the Senate, right?
Mostly because it would flip the Senate, but not just that. I mean, Lieberman was the only one who joined, only non-Republican, who joined with Republicans to filibuster that non-binding resolution, which would have expressed a no-confidence vote in Gonzales. He is a loyal Bushy, and he will take to a higher level all of those policies amassing executive power that Alberto Gonzales has started.
Which leads us to the ultimate bottom line, which is we need to defy any loyal Bushy in that position.
That's right.
Yeah. Marjorie Cohn, MarjorieCohn.com, her website, president of the National Lawyers Guild, professor at Thomas Jefferson School of Law. Her new book, Cowboy Republic, 6 Ways the Bush Gang Has Defied the Law. Thank you, Marjorie, for being with us.
My pleasure, Tom.
27.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Speaking of free falling, Mitt Romney's advisor, Senator Larry Craig, in free fall now, accused of soliciting another man in a men's room in an airport. Actually, not just accused, but pled guilty to disorderly conduct. He's now saying he pled guilty to get out of the hassle of a trial and that he wasn't guilty. But back in 1982... his name had surfaced, along with several other members of Congress, in a page scandal. This was back when he was in the House of Representatives. This is from an interview with one of the pages, speaking not specifically of Larry Craig, but of a group of members of Congress who were never named.
On at least one occasion, a certain official in the House invited several pages out to his house where cocaine and hashish and marijuana were freely available to the pages.
If you could put a number on the number of congressional employees that you may have direct knowledge of involvement in illicit activity, how many would that be?
Direct knowledge, 15 to 20.
And then, without apparently being prompted, Larry Craig, who at the time was single, came out in defense of himself, even though his name hadn't been mentioned.
Persons who are unmarried, as I am, by choice or by circumstance, have always been the subject of innuendos, gossip, and false accusations. I think this is despicable.
Indeed. And you know, clearly, there's nothing at all wrong with being gay, but there is something wrong with being a hypocrite. So, anyhow, we'll follow that. I am most concerned, though, about this whole thing with Joe Lieberman. Robin in Pinckney, Michigan. Hey, Robin, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just had a comment on Joe Lieberman. I don't think he's the kind that would take a temporary position like this for just a year and a few months, giving up what would be effectively probably 4 years of his Senate seat.
And well, here's a scenario. What if Joe Lieberman were to take the position of Attorney General, were to do that admirably for, say, 9 months or so, for, you know, most of the rest of the Bush term?
Correct.
And then about 4 months before Bush leaves office, Dick Cheney decides that his pacemaker isn't doing all that well and he needs to step down. And so let's take a cabinet official and put him in as vice president. Lieberman becomes vice president and then becomes a great candidate for vice president to run along with Giuliani or Romney or whomever, or possibly even a candidate for Republican as president.
That's possible, but, you know, I mean, he'd have to switch parties, which he
sure
hasn't done yet, and also...
Well, actually, he has. He's already left the Democratic Party.
Correct, but he is caucusing with the Democrats under some
right
kind of loose understanding that he'll stay caucusing with them.
Right.
And they'll, yeah, they all... You know, I asked Carl Levin personally whether he thought Levin or whether he thought Lieberman would switch parties, and he said no. That, you know, he felt pretty comfortable that he wasn't going to do that and
yeah
caucus with the Republicans.
Well, and I understand that part of the reason for that is that there are new Senate rules that basically say that if, you know, that were put into place by the Republicans when Jim Jeffords left the Republican Party and all of a sudden the Senate flipped to the Democrats.
Right.
So that if during the term of a Senate, which would be through the end of 2008 now and through January 2009, if somebody leaves and the control of the Senate flips, the control of the Senate doesn't actually flip. That is to say, the chairmanships remain with the party that was in power. So if Joe Lieberman were to leave the Senate and the governor, the Republican governor of Connecticut, were to appoint a Republican, the chairmanships of the Senate would stay with the Democrats, although the voting majority would now be the Republicans. Although for all practical purposes, you know, Tim Johnson is out of the loop. And you got Dick Cheney for ties, and you got Joe Lieberman voting as a Republican, at least with regard to the war and warmongering issues to begin with. It may or may not be a big deal or a big change. A lot, I suppose, would depend on who was appointed to replace him. But I have to believe that Joe Lieberman, more than anything in the world, wants to be president. And this is a you know, a two-step path to that. Whereas I think he very much realizes that his tenure in the Senate as an independent, I mean, he's either going to be a senator for a while or it's a dead end, basically. It's not going to go any farther than that. So we'll see. But it's an interesting observation, and thank you very much for that, Robin. Harry in Boulder, Colorado. Hey, Harry.
Good morning, Tom. I was calling about Senator Lieberman also, and I think it'd be kind of, it's an interesting scenario, but I'm not sure that he would be willing to leave for a temporary position. But if he did, if he were to carry on his predecessor's policies, then I think he would be placing himself in a rather untenable position, and he may find himself prosecutable in the future in the same way that Mr. Gonzalez may be.
Except that most of those policies have already now been pulled back from. I mean, you know, some of them are now enshrined in law and all that kind of thing, but a lot of them they're pulling back on, they're pulling away from. And they're not such bright and obvious violations of the Constitution and the law at this moment as they were, you know, a few years ago. But, you know, good point. An interesting point, Harry. Thank you. Bob in Thousand Oaks, California. Hey, Bob.
Hey, Tom. How are you doing? I got a quick question for you, and I talked to you a couple of months ago at the time that there was a lot of discussion about Lieberman changing parties. I asked, you know, how that would affect the flipping of the Senate, and you said it really wouldn't have an effect because of the fact that Bernie Sanders is an independent and he caucuses with the Democrats. Now, is that same thing true now, or do we have something to worry about?
I'm missing your question, Bob.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
There was talk that Joe Lieberman a couple of months ago might change parties, and
right.
if he did, that would flip the Senate. I called you and asked you for your take on that, and you said that because of the fact that Bernie Sanders is an independent, but he caucuses with a Democrat, the fact
right.
that Lieberman would change parties really wouldn't have an effect on the Senate.
That wasn't my point. Right now, Lieberman is caucusing with the Democrats, as is Bernie Sanders. And these two independents, both caucusing with the Democrats, are what gave the Democrats the majority when this session of the Senate began, which runs until the end of Bush's term, until this congressional term. The point is, under the Senate rules 4 years ago, when Jim Jeffords left the Republican Party and became an independent, under those Senate rules, if Lieberman was to become a Republican, or if Lieberman's seat was to be replaced by a Republican, the control of the Senate, which includes the person who is controlling the agenda for the floor of the Senate and includes the chairmanships of the various committees, would flip to the Republican Party. My understanding is, and we really, this is something I need to do a little more research on and something we can talk to Bernie about on Friday, but my understanding is that those rules were changed because the Republicans were so horrified by that happening, they wanted to make sure it didn't happen again. So now the rule is that whoever is in charge of the Senate, whichever party is in charge of the Senate at the beginning of the term of the Senate, remains in charge of the Senate all the way through the end of the term, even if somebody in the Senate flips, dies, changes, Strom Thurmond gets too old, whatever. This was originally put into place by the Republicans as a defensive move, but now it would work to the benefit of the Democrats. That's my
right.
understanding. Now it's possible I'm wrong on that, but I don't think so. We've had several discussions about this, so we'll see what happens. Judy in Mahwah, New Jersey. Hey, Judy.
Hi. It's a pleasure Hi. To talk to you. Actually, it's an honor. I admire you
Thank
so
you.
Much. And I, too, am worried about Joe Lieberman, and I'm worried about recess appointments, even though there's supposed to be this deal in place, since one of the Republicans kept their word about anything. And yesterday I called Harry Reid's office and begged him to bring the Senate back into session to cut off recess appointments because I don't trust them. And whatever they can do, they will, I think.
Yeah, well, see, this is where, appointing Joe Lieberman would be the ultimate master stroke, because the Senate is not going to refuse to confirm a member of its own body. I mean, it's, in my opinion, I agree with Marjorie that we should raise holy hell about it, but I just don't see it happening. I mean, probably the most confirmable person on earth in terms of being confirmed by the Senate is another senator. Even one who's, not all that popular, because it's this collegial body. These guys, even bitter political enemies, sit around and slap each other's backs and have lunch together and think of each other as, wonderful guys, et cetera, et cetera. So 1-866-303-2270, your telephone number. Rich in Stratford, Connecticut. Hey, Rich, you're from Lieberman country.
Yeah, I could tell you that putting Lieberman as the AG would be a disaster. He is a Bushy 100%. He's just going to be another stooge of George Bush. And on top of that, Jody Rao, our governor, she's a true Republican. She's going to nominate somebody who is a true Republican.
And what does that mean?
That would mean
a true hard right Republican or a true, like, Eisenhower Republican?
For the state of Connecticut, she is very right of center.
She's very popular. I mean, she won by over 60%, didn't she?
But the person she nominates would vote down the party line. That would put it a 50-50 split on any vote going up into the Senate, and who would be the tiebreaker then?
Yeah.
That would be a double whammy disaster for us.
Yeah, because then the guy who gets to decide the vote.
You don't know the power of the dark side.
Yeah, yeah, it becomes him. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio.
Still last 10 years like they should.
All right.
The best dog, the free life behind us now. The good time's really over for good.
Stop rolling downhill like a snowball headed for hell.
Thank you, Will.
Stand up for the flag and let's all ring the Liberty Bell.
Let's make a Ford and a Chevy that would still last 10 years like they should. 'Cause the best of the free life is still yet to come. The good times ain't over.
Well, it ain't over for good if we could get some rational trade agreements and get some of our corporate behavior under control. Thank you for that, Merle Haggard. Welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Think Progress reporting that NBC is reporting that the speculation is that George J. Terwilliger III is looking good to replace Alberto Gonzalez. Also, Ted Olson and Lawrence Silberman in the running. Chertoff now considered unlikely, Larry Johnson considered unlikely. Terwilliger, by the way, was the leader of Bush's legal team during the Florida election recount, which would mean that he worked with John Roberts in helping them figure out how to argue before the Supreme Court that for the state of Florida to recount every vote per the state of Florida Supreme Court requirement, you know, their ruling, that to recount every vote in order to determine whether Gore or Bush win would cause, quote, irreparable harm to plaintiff George W. Bush, end quote. And the Supreme Court did decide that, and so this is a guy. But who knows? Samir in Camas, Washington. Samir, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to say that I actually support Joe Lieberman for the job. I hate Joe Lieberman. I hate everything he stands for, but I think that it's the only way to get him out of the Senate. We tried so hard last year to get rid of him, and it just didn't work. And I think that if this gets him out of the Senate, it lets him cause damage for a couple years, but that's better than, you know, six, which he got in 2006.
You know, that was my initial response, you know, when I first heard this rumor about 4 or 5 hours ago was, you know, okay, fine, we get Lieberman out of the Senate. And then I thought, okay, if I'm Joe Lieberman, how am I thinking of this? And, you know, what would be the long-term strategy? And I really think the long-term strategy would be to replace Cheney. And in fact, I think that probably the only way that he would go in, and this is assuming that, you know, there is some truth to these rumors, the only way that he would go in as AG is if he was guaranteed that he would get the VP position. And that way he either, A, has his place in history as vice president, and he can go out with the end of the administration and just have his name in the history books as the vice president of the United States, you know, and you know, because this is a guy who's clearly motivated by his history, you know, his historic legacy, I guess, would be the word.
Right.
Or would be in a position to get back in the game running for vice president of the United States like he did with Al Gore, only this time with a Republican candidate. and perhaps able to balance a Republican candidate, you know, as the solid conservative guy, able to balance a Republican candidate like Rudy Giuliani, who's viewed with a jaundiced eye by the social conservatives, on the one hand, or somebody like Mike Huckabee, who is, you know, the darling of the social conservatives, but, you know, they're not really all that sure about his position on national security issues, because Lieberman is solid on both. I mean, he's the ultimate Republican candidate, except he's not a Republican, right? And he's not a candidate. So, you know, it would be, you know, one way to get it in there. It's an interesting thought. Samir, thanks for the call. Phil in Long Island, New York. Hey, Phil.
Hey, Tom, pleasure. I just wanted to briefly tell you, I understand everybody's thinking it would be ideal for Joe Lieberman, for Bush to do that. But if you think about it from Bush's point of view, Lieberman would then be privy to all the inside dirt. And there's no way they're going to let, especially a guy like Joe Lieberman, have all the inside dirt. They're going for an insider. It's going to probably be Olson, or it's going to be Terwilliger, like you said.
Yeah, my inclination is to agree with you, because the Gonzo's main job up until this point has been to rubber stamp insane, you know, policy decisions like, gee, let's torture people. What a great idea arguably sadists and sociopaths within the Bush administration, all leading all the way up to the top, by the way.
Exactly.
Including himself, and to cover up the crimes of same.
Exactly.
And
Gonzo was just there for CYA, exactly.
Sure, exactly. And he's been doing it for George ever since he covered up his cocaine and his drunken driving convictions back, you know, arrests and convictions back as governor of Texas. But the question is Lieberman really that much of an outsider, or over the last couple of years since he became an independent and won in the Senate and has been sucking up to the Bush administration, has he become an insider? I mean, to what extent is Lieberman willing to sell out? I think that verdict is still out.
I know the guy. He's not he's probably not the most ideal guy for the Democrats to want to be nominated. But I think that would actually, I think that would be encouraging for Democrats for them to nominate him, because it would be a foot in the door.
You think Lieberman still has a shred of integrity, and as AG, he may actually.
I'm going to give the man the benefit of the doubt. I don't think he has much, but there is, like you said, a shred.
Yeah, very, very, very interesting. Well, we'll see. Phil, thanks a lot for the call. We'll see. It's going to be a very interesting time, as they say. And you know, over the next few days, we'll see how this all shakes out. Gunner in Long Beach, California. Just a real quick one here. We got to wrap up this hour in a minute.
Quick question, Tom. If the if Lieberman went over to the AG and the Republican governor replaced him, would that be through Lieberman's term, or would that just be through the end of the congressional session?
That's a good question, and I don't know the answer to that. I believe it would be through the end of Lieberman's term. I think it's going to depend on the Constitution of the state of Connecticut and or the laws in the state of Connecticut, and I frankly don't know. 57 minutes past the hour.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
Welcome back. In February, this is Dateline London, article by Elizabeth Rosenthal, Sunday, April 9, 2006. In February, when Rob O. saw the text message pop up on his cell phone from Paracel International, healthy males needed for drug trial for £2,000, about $2,500, $3,000, it seemed like a harmless opportunity to make much-needed cash. Paracel, based in Waltham, Massachusetts, contracts with drug makers to test new medicines. Just weeks later, the previously healthy 31-year-old was in intensive care at London's Northwick Park Hospitals. Wires running into his heart and arteries on dialysis, his immune system, liver, kidneys, and lungs all failing. One of six healthy young men to receive TGN-1412, a novel type of immune stimulant that had never been used in humans. He agreed to speak for this article on condition his family name not be used. Although in monkeys, this drug showed no signs of trouble. All six human subjects nearly died. One is still hospitalized, and others, though discharged, have impaired immune systems, and their future health is uncertain. Similarly, Sherilyn Mathias was ready to blow the whistle on Dr. Michael McGee 2 years ago. It had been clear for quite some time something fishy was going on. For one thing, there were the hokey infomercials touting his experimental vaccine for malignant melanoma, a particularly nasty form of cancer, as if it were a Vegematic. Thanks to the vaccine, a patient declared on screen, my cancer is in total remission. A little too good to be true, it turns out. Alex Epstein is with us. He's a junior fellow at the Ayn Rand Institute, AYNRAND.org. The folks, the objectivists, who are the thinkers behind the thinkers who became the libertarians and the modern-day conservatives, holding the torch of Ayn Rand, Atlas Shrugged. Alex Epstein, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me again.
You're welcome. Your article, The Deadly FDA, you are suggesting there was a patient who recently sued in the federal court of the District of Columbia, the Federal Court of Appeals, to be allowed to be given a drug that had never before been given to humans. And the FDA said, no, this thing has to be tested to make sure that this guy doesn't croak from it, even though he was, you know, presumably fatally ill. And the court ruled that, in fact, the Food and Drug Administration does have the right to decide whether or not, even in clinical trials, people can be given drugs. And you think that that's wrong. Why?
Yeah, absolutely. First of all, what do I think? I think that the individual should be free to ingest whatever substance he chooses that he believes will be in his medical interest, and that he should do so in consultation with doctors, with scientists, and with private, not the FDA, private drug testing and evaluation agencies. And the current policy we have, where we have an FDA, is that no matter what the individual judges and no matter what scientists judge about the most effective way to take drugs and what the safety status is of a drug, the FDA can coercively prevent an individual from taking a drug that may well save his life. So it's up to the individual's right to decide what is in his interest, including when he is terminally ill or potentially terminally ill, whether he should take a risky experimental drug. And the fact that the FDA can stop this and that it can declare what is risky has cost hundreds of thousands of lives over the years.
Well, and on the flip side, hundreds of thousands of lives, arguably millions of lives over the years, have been lost by quack medicine and its variations. I mean, don't we also, as individuals, have a right to live in a society where we can collectively say, okay, we're going to organize in a way to prevent ourselves from being harmed by predators? I mean, I would have to assume that at least part of the answer from you would be yes, because you're in favor of police and prisons. What's the difference?
Well, I'm not sure what you mean as collectively get together. Anyone,
you and the rest of
the staff at Air America Radio and anyone else who wants to are free to set up a private quack detection agency or a private drug evaluation agency that goes to the public and says, these drugs are bogus, this science is bogus, this isn't. And in fact, this kind of thing is urgently needed and is discouraged by the FDA.
Like I'm going to do that with the extra income in my paycheck.
Well, there would be a private demand for it, and if there were no FDA, then there would be a huge value for drug companies to have certification from an independent agency that said this meets our standards and this didn't, and then you would have competing agencies and individuals and doctors could judge for themselves which met standards and which don't. But as it stands, what we have is we have a government dictating this is healthy, this isn't, whether it's drugs, whether it's food, and that does all kinds of destruction because it prevents individuals from using treatments that would benefit them, and it gives a false stamp of approval to treatments that are potentially
You know, let's not try to filibuster each other here, Alex. So once again, you're suggesting that it's okay for us to organize together to protect ourselves from predators who might break into our homes. It's okay for us to organize through the instrument of social organization called government and have police and prisons. That's a good thing. But it's not okay for us to organize together to protect ourselves from corporate predators who may want to sell us for a fast buck a drug.
Okay, well, that's a good question. So we just have to be clear on what we mean by predators. Absolutely, we have a right to, or a government is there to protect rights. So we have a government, and it's necessary. So we have a right to establish a government to protect rights, which includes protection against fraud. So if by quack you mean someone claims that this drug has been tested and it's safe and that it has these positive effects and the absence of these negative effects, and it doesn't, that is fraud, and that person should be prosecuted.
But see, here's the problem with
that's for courts.
No, but see, here's the problem. Yeah, but what that does is it remedies problems after they've happened. I mean, the problem with your solution, and I understand your solution, and it makes perfect sense logically, and I can see where, you know, anybody who really didn't have much experience, and not to put you down, I mean, where some college student would say, oh, hey, you know, or an idealist would say, this is a perfect idea. Of course it makes sense. But the problem is that the ability to put together a business and start selling snake oil, start selling, you know, mercury solutions or some weird herb or some poison or whatever, can be done literally in a day. And you can even claim that this private organization has given you the stamp of approval. You can do business for two or three weeks in one town, and then by the time the private organization figures it out and somebody files a lawsuit, which might take 6 months or a year to go through the courts, those people are gone. They have vanished. They've moved off to another city. You got predators constantly roaming around. Instead, we collectively said, we're going to protect ourselves from this, from harm, proactively, preventatively, rather than after the fact, by saying that no, you cannot sell a remedy for a disease. You cannot sell a drug until we, the people, collectively, through an agency we call the Food and Drug Administration, has decided that it's safe.
Right, but the objection I raised before completely applies to this, which is that the thing that, quote, we the people, and obviously I'm not included in that, decide collectively that forbids.
Why are you not included in that?
Because I don't agree to it. I don't agree to having this agency dictate what I can and can't ingest. Now, you mentioned the issue of snake oil.
So, well, hang on just a second. So you're saying you're not part of our society?
No filibustering your way either. So if you talk about being proactive, that is absolutely something people should do, but that's something that they should do on an individual basis and then on an organizational basis.
So they should all become molecular biologists.
No, this is why we have a division of labor. This is why you should have private agencies. But absolutely, every time a new thing comes on the market, it is completely irresponsible for an individual to just ingest it haphazardly and say, well, on TV they said this, so I'm going to take that. I don't do that at all with my health. Most of these supplements I know nothing about, and I don't know of agencies that rate them in a way that I judge correctly, so I avoid them. And that's
but I mean, this is the problem we had before the Pure Food and Drug Administration was created, was that people were just popping up out of nowhere and selling stuff off the back of their trucks and killing people.
Okay, but if it's fraudulent, they should be prosecuted. But it's the individual.
But they're long gone by the time it's determined.
It's the individual's. No, they're not long gone. They're trackable. But it's the individual's responsibility. And if someone, you don't treat everyone as criminals in advance because someone is criminal. It's the individual's responsibility. It's his judgment. It's his life. And if someone commits fraud, then he should be prosecuted.
So you said you're not
the fact that he might commit fraud does not justify prosecuting all of the innocent people offering beneficial treatments that the FDA has forbid and gotten people killed by over the years.
So you're suggesting, by saying that you're not included in this group, that you're not a member of our society. You don't use public roads. You don't use public transportation. You don't use all those things that are paid for by tax dollars because you disagree with them?
No, obviously I'm an American citizen, and there are many things about that that make me very proud. But I do not regard the FDA as having my endorsement or sanction. If somebody voted to abolish it, and especially it's abolish its power to keep drugs off the market, I would vote for that in a second. But I disagree with the majority, and the majority in this case is oppressing me. So I'm not, quote, we the people. I'm their victim.
I see. Okay. Alex Epstein, junior fellow at the Ayn Rand Institute,
AYNRAND.
Say what?
I said, and so are you, whether you know it or not.
Okay. A couple of mutual victims here. Alex Epstein, thanks for being with us today.
All right. Thanks, Tom.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio.
you've got a headache. Now I've got some strange disease, don't worry about it. This pill will set your mind at ease. It's called Progenitorivox. It's made by Squab Merle Co. It's a life-enhancing miracle, but there are some things you should know.
It may cause agitation, palpitations, excessive salivation, constipation, male lactation, rust-colored urination, hallucinations, bad vibrations, mild electric shock sensations.
But it's worth it for the drugs I need. My disease may not be fatal, but I can ease my fears by taking two $12 pills each day for 50 years. They've spent billions to convince me, so now I realize Progenitorivox beats diet and exercise. I've got insurance.
Yeah, just take the pills, right? 22 so minutes past the hour. You know, the old Andy Card said it. Set it right. Just to change the subject somewhat, we can continue this conversation about whether or not there should be a Food and Drug Administration. In fact, let me just riff on that for a second before I get to Andy Card and new products in the fall. And that is that the bigger picture here is whether you trust, whether we as a people trust ourselves to establish institutions to protect ourselves, and those institutions have one goal and one goal only, not to make a profit, but to protect the American people from predators among us. Whether they be police departments or fire departments or the Food and Drug Administration or the U.S. Department of Agriculture, whether we trust those institutions to function and to be answerable to us, or whether we think that the so-called free market, that private corporate interests, whose first goal is to make a profit, will do a better job. And that is one of the primary and fundamental cleavages between the conservative world, the liberal worldview and the conservative worldview, is that the liberal worldview on which this country was founded is that we are a we society. This was the foundational notion of the Enlightenment of the 1600s that led directly to the creation of the United States. That we are a we society, that we're all in this together, that we're collectively all here together, working together, being together. It's about all of us. Whereas the historic conservative worldview is, it's about me. I got mine. And the only purpose of government is to protect me and mine from anybody else who wants to take any part of me and mine. And the we, the hell with the we. Now, you know, certainly there are some folks who think that, well, okay, there is a we, and the we is better served by this so-called free market. But if you look at history, you find that it just ain't the case. There has never been a society ever that operated in a libertarian fashion or an objectivist fashion or a pure conservative fashion that didn't end up being essentially a dictatorship of a small elite with a large working poor class, and only a fractional and very, very small middle class. It's what Dickens wrote about over and over and over again. And I mean, his father was thrown in a debtor's prison. He was intimately familiar with this. It's the story of A Christmas Carol. Unregulated capitalism. And Scrooge wasn't even part of the oppressive class. I mean, you know, Scrooge was a small business owner. He was the middle class of his day. He was not, you know, one of the inherited, those with great inherited wealth or a member of the royal family. I mean, that's how weird it was that even the middle class was oppressive of the working poor. And so you had Bob Cratchit. Oh, please, Mr. Scrooge, may I have another lump of coal to put in the fire? My hands are too cold to write in this ledger. No, you may not have another lump of coal. It'll cost me a pence. What are you trying to do, bankrupt me? Well, may I please have health care for Tiny Tim, my son? No, you may not. What health care? Are you kidding? And that's the world that cons want to reinvent for all of us. And taking a shot at all the various government institutions, I mean, you know, it comes back to, you know, ultimately it comes back to Reagan's notion that government is the problem, not the solution.
I've always felt the 9 most terrifying words in the English language are,
I'm from the government, and I'm here to help.
Tell that to the people who lived through Hurricane Katrina. Tell that to the people who've lived through any natural disaster too large for a local community to deal with. Tell that to the people who have died throughout the history of this country before the creation of the FDA as a consequence of snake oil and medicines that were sold to them with all kinds of paperwork showing that it was definitely approved and it worked, and even the President of the United States takes this stuff. It is marvelous. It's not that there's a sucker born every minute. It's that there's a hustler born every minute. And we, the people, collectively get together and say, we're going to protect ourselves from the predators. We're going to protect ourselves from the hustlers. Just like we agree we're going to protect ourselves from the guy who's going to try and break into our house by having a police department, we're also going to protect ourselves from the guy who's going to try and break into our body for a profit with the snake oil medication, with a phony drug, by having a Food and Drug Administration. I want to riff just very, very briefly when we come back from the break about how Andy Card said, you don't roll out a new product in the summer. You roll out a new product in the fall. You'll recall he said that in the summer of 2002, they rolled out the war in Iraq immediately. And as soon as September began in 2002, they are fixing to roll out the war in Iran in the next couple of weeks. Stick around.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Don't forget, by the way, this Friday I'll be live on C-SPAN, noon to 3 Eastern Time, which is when the show is normally live, 9 to noon Pacific, noon to 3 Eastern. Check your local listings, but I believe most C-SPAN locations will be carrying it live. That'll be this Friday, August 31st, and we're going to have a lot of fun with it. And, in fact, we're trying to set it up. You know, there's some technical stuff here, but we're trying to set it up so that we can even, during the commercial breaks, be taking calls from C-SPAN viewers and just keep on going with the show for all 3 hours. I don't know. Maybe I'm going to have to do the astronaut diaper thing or something. It's going to be a lot of fun. Anyhow, a number of reports here, and Larissa Alexandrovna is going to be on from Raw Story tomorrow to discuss this at some more length, but that the United States is ginning up for an attack against Iran. And Joe Scarborough talking with Pat Buchanan about this over at MSNBC, and Buchanan saying, don't worry, essentially the Democrats are going to, well, here's his exact quote. He says, my guess would be that Barack Obama and Ms. Hillary and the others would be in a state of paralysis, because it might be a very popular initial move, that is, to go after the nuclear sites inside Iran. Because it might be a very popular initial move and elements of the Democratic Party would support. You take Joe Lieberman, would cheer his head off. I think if you took polls of the American people, they would put Iran right at the top of America's enemy list, Buchanan says. He says, so I think in the Democratic Party, of course, you got, with due respect, you got the Israeli lobby and Israel, you've got the hardline like Lieberman, but you got the neoconservatives, and you got a lot of evangelical Christians and others who think this is a real menace and you ought to hit them. Jeez. And then on the other hand, you know, we've got over at Drudge, an AP report, President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad warned Tuesday that a power vacuum is imminent in Iraq and that Iran is ready to help fill the gap. Now, what I see in all this, and as I said, we will talk at some length with Larissa about this tomorrow, but what I'm seeing in all this is the preparation to roll the product out. Hey, this is Tom Hartman. We appear to be having a bit of a technical problem right now. I'll be back live with you in just a few minutes, but for the moment, just hang on and enjoy this music. Hey, this is Tom Hartman. We appear to be having a bit of a technical problem right now. I'll be back live with you in just a few minutes, but for the moment, just hang on and enjoy this music. Anyhow, sorry about that. We dropped our ISDN line and our backup apparently wasn't in place. The point I was making is that I think that the whole situation with Larry Craig going away and with that you don't roll out a product in August. You roll it out in September. And the Republican and this is why I think they're going to try and Larry Craig is probably going to resign in my opinion in the next few weeks. And be replaced by a reliable Republican who can run for re-election in that seat, because otherwise that seat's going to flip Democratic. And similarly, they're ginning up for a war in Iran for the same purposes. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. A whole lot on the table, from the USDA and the FDA to the war in Iran. Ed in Hollywood, California, listening on a K-Talk. Hey, Ed, what's up?
Well, I just wanted to say I totally agree with you about having a Food and Drug Administration. My problem is with the current one, I think it's already privatized. I think we've got a lot of CEOs that have joined the Food and Drug Administration, and I think it's become way too political. I'd like to know, for example, what's in my food? What's the genetically altered food that I'm buying that I don't know I'm buying? You've got your partially hydrogenated oils.
Yeah, that's all the U.S. Department of Agriculture, but I absolutely agree with you, and this goes back to Reagan. This goes back to Reagan's deregulating everything and bringing government into, and in particular, during the Bush administration, the first Bush administration, Dan Quayle's initiative, what was it called, the National Competitiveness Initiative, where they were looking for ways to make government more basically privatized. And,
right.
Yeah, we need to undo that because it used to work. It used to work. And now you've got it right now in the United States. There are over 30 million people who have chronic digestive problems. And the best guess as to why that's going on, everything from IBS to chronic diarrhea to some what looks like variations on celiac disease and other things, but may not be. One of the best guesses is that what's going on is that there's just a massive amount of contamination of our food supply by bacteria. And a lot of it may well be foods coming in from overseas that are not being checked. I mean, less than 1% is being checked. John in Longmont, Colorado on this topic. Hey, John.
Hey there, Tom. And, you're talking about the USDA being needed to help us out, but the USDA, being in the cattle industry, they don't allow you to check for mad cow disease. And,
Right, and that's another example of the pressure of business on government. So obviously the solution isn't to have a private agency doing it, because a private agency would be even more responsive to the demands of business. The answer is to say, sorry, you can't lobby the USDA, you can't lobby Congress if you're the cattle industry.
What?
I mean, this is crazy that a cattle rancher can't test his cattle for mad cow disease so that he can sell them in Japan.
Well, but
or in the United States for that matter.
Yeah, well, you've got so much regulation from the USDA right now that it's really causing problems. They want us to track our cows from moving from one pasture to the next, and it's rather ridiculous what the amount of labor they're trying to create. So,
yet at the same time, I don't think that they're trying to create labor. This is not a full employment act. If they wanted to create labor, they'd rebuild our bridges. What this is about is an attempt to track, meat in the meat supply in a way that it can be tracked back if something is determined to have mad cow disease. And the fatal flaw in it is that they're not allowing ranchers to test for mad cow disease, which these days is not that expensive or complex a test. And, frankly, because they have bowed to the cattlemen's industry and said, okay, we won't do that. As a consequence of that, they're having to have you guys jump through all these other hoops as a sort of secondary backup system to prevent harm after it's happened. And it's an example of what happens when a government agency that is supposed to be doing its job of protecting the people instead gets contaminated by pressure from industry, in my humble opinion. Errol in Greeley, Colorado, from Colorado.
Hello.
To Colorado. Hey, Errol.
The government has been lost to this corporate cronyism that this administration has put forward. Berta Gonzalez is a perfect example, but Mike Leavitt at the Health and Human Services and the control they exert on the FDA has created total corruption. I'm going to give you an example. There has been a cure for diabetes for years, yet these people have kept it down. They don't want it to see the light of day. They've kept this man from getting permits. His name is Mark Hammerman. He's at the George Washington University in St. Louis, and anybody can look him up on the computer.
Yeah,
he
Errol, I'm, you know, yes, and I can give you 50 other things that you can look up on the computer that are cures for cancer and every other disease in the world. I'm not buying it, and I'm not going there. If somebody has figured out a way to cure diabetes, you can't stop it from getting out. I really don't think that you could stop it from getting out. Ashley in Los Angeles, maybe I'm naive, but I don't think so. Ashley in L.A., California.
No, hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I just want to make a comment about the libertarian that you had on earlier. Mm-hmm. And
he's actually an objectivist. They're even more pure than the libertarians.
Okay, that's even worse, actually, because I know Ayn Rand really supported a gold standard in the monetary system as a regulatory force. And I just can't take anyone who calls himself a libertarian seriously if they're not first and foremost pounding the desk about the Keynesian economic system we have. In fact, I think any discussion at all of regulating or deregulating the marketplace that doesn't address the morally depraved, predatory, usurious monetary system we have is doing whatever cause or whatever ideology you support little or no good at all, because it's addressing the symptoms of the monetary system and not.
In other words, you're an opponent of the Fed.
Oh yes, absolutely.
So what would you replace the Fed with? If we go back to the gold standard, then the value of gold within the United States, the value of our dollar, would vary from year to year based on the size of the economy, right?
Well, in my opinion, I think that gold should just be allowed to, the price of gold should be allowed to rise and fall with the market. What we have
it does right now.
We do not have a free marketplace. The price of gold, and this has been admitted to by Alan Greenspan himself, who said that we stand ready, the Fed stands ready to release gold into the marketplace should we need to the price to decline. So
why would the Fed care what the price of gold is? The price of gold has gone up a couple hundred bucks in the last.
I bought gold at
$300 an ounce just 5 years ago, and it's like 600 and something now.
To keep it down. Well, Tom, gold is a harbinger of inflation.
Yeah, so is oil. I mean, there's a lot of, and so is copper, so is nickel, so is platinum.
So it does sound good when they have a fiat currency system that they want to prop up and maintain. Yeah.
I am not a big advocate of the Fed. I'll tell you that right up front. But if you go to a straight gold system, you're going the value of the currency of the United States is going to depend on how much physical gold we have.
The Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. On Air America Radio. Call 866-303-2270.
Before the hour, Ellen Ratner with us with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Hey, Ellen.
Well, as you know, Washington is obsessed with sex scandals, and today Larry Craig gave Washington one of the biggest sex scandals of the year. He resigned, or Romney kicked him off of running Idaho from him and his national committee. But I want to give a minority opinion here about this. There was a book written in 1970, I believe, called Tea Room Trade by Laud Humphreys, and you could look it up on the Internet. It's there. And Laud Humphreys, I believe, was reprimanded by the American Sociological Association for the book and also given an award for the book. What he basically did is he found these bathrooms on the highway where men would go to have sex with men, and he would act as sort of the lookout and then follow the men out of the bathroom, take down their license plates, and 6 months later send a graduate student to their house to pretend as if they were doing a regular survey. Found out that most of these guys that were frequently in these places were married with three children. Or 2.3 or whatever, I don't remember the exact book. But what it really dealt with, and all these bathrooms around, there would be all over the country, they were known as tea rooms. And this is where men would have sex with men. Now, I don't like hypocrites, and Larry Craig sounds like he's a hypocrite. But I will also say that entrapment of people and using police resources to entrap men who are having sex with men, and also to essentially not make it, I mean, that in a sense it reflects the internalized homophobia in our society as well. And
now, you know, I would agree with you if it was not a public bathroom.
I understand that.
You know, because
you don't want little boys walking in. I agree with that 100%.
That's right. I'm absolutely opposed to entrapment. I think that our government back in the 60s and 70s just started going way over the edge. I think that the entrapment that is used now is unconstitutional and wildly excessive. But like I said, in a public bathroom, it's a little different thing. I think the tragedy of Larry Craig, and this is something Richard Kim posted this over at The Nation, and I think it's a really interesting note. Richard says, I wonder if the GOP's burgeoning bathroom problem isn't reflective of something larger than just a bunch of conservative dudes who couldn't come out of the closet. There's something palpably sad about what happened to Alan and Craig, too. Something oddly touching about their misplaced faith in the fading world of secret anonymous gay sex. That world, once found in bathrooms, parks, piers, and adult bookstores, the furtive refugees of adventuresome queers, married men, the curious, has been swept away by so many police raids, privatization schemes, quality of life campaigns, and internet dating services. But mostly it's fallen away as gays have become increasingly integrated into the mainstream, and also paradoxically more marked than ever. You're either gay or you're not seems to be the equation. And it's almost like the world has changed under these guys, and they're still living
in the 50s. Well, that's right. I mean, if you look at Larry Craig's age, that is really how men had sex with men. You know, by bass and bushes, as we used to say, the three B's.
Right. Yeah.
And obviously that changed with AIDS. It changed as gay people were more out of the closet, et cetera. And Craig is of the age that is where people and how they got sex.
Yeah, and really, in a way, it's all the more the tragedy. I mean, I see this as you know, if he was one of the most outspoken of the family values crowd and one of the, you know, the hyper campaigners and all that kind of stuff, then I would, you know, I'd really be going after him for the hypocrisy. But I see this really as a tragedy. I'm just curious, how long is it going to be before the Republican Party throws him over the edge of the boat?
Well, you know what's interesting is all of a sudden, I mean, we didn't hear a peep from Ari Fleischer for about a year, year and a half. And all of a sudden, you know, he's everywhere from talking about metal baseball bats to this, you know, this new ad campaign.
Well, is he the new sock puppet for Karl Rove?
I am beginning to wonder if he's not on the White House's sock puppet payroll somehow through the RNC or someone, because now he's saying he doesn't think Craig can survive this. I mean, he's on that same this morning. So he is doing something for someone. They have revived him for a reason. And I can't quite, you know, figure out who he's absolutely in allegiance to. But I think your theory of Karl Rove may be correct.
Yeah. Or if not Karl Rove, I mean, Karl Rove isn't the only smart guy in the Republican Party who knows how to play Machiavelli. You know.
Right, but don't forget, Fleischer essentially worked with Karl Rove, or for Karl Rove, or whoever a press secretary truly works for in the White House all of that time. So Fleischer and Rove have a relationship.
Right, it goes way back. And if somebody, you know, if somebody like Richard Mellon Scaife were to come along and say, okay, Rove's now a free agent, Fleischer's now a free agent, hey guys, here's a couple million bucks, go do what you do so well. And now they're able to make out in the private sector, you know, what they couldn't do in the government sector, and still do the bidding of the conservatives.
Exactly. So you know how you say watch the birdie? Watch Fleischer, because he's going to keep popping up in various ways over the next 6 to 8 months, and I think that is going to be reflective of what the administration wants out there.
And the other way I think we're going to see him popping up is, remember Andy Card saying you don't roll a product out in the summer, you wait until the fall? I'm betting that the product they're going to roll out this fall is a war with Iran. What do you think? Oh, and
well,
the other quick question.
Real quick question.
What do you think of the possibility Lieberman might replace Gonzalez?
And leave his Senate seat for a job that is only a year and a half? I would not say it's great.
Okay, what if he cut a deal with Bush where Cheney says 4 months out, he's going to resign, Lieberman becomes vice president, and he has his place in history. He might position himself to be a vice presidential candidate or even a presidential candidate for the GOP, which is a pretty weak field. Plus, the governor of Connecticut is a Republican. She would replace a Republican to appoint him, so the Republicans take control of the Senate.
That's quite a theory, but...
You think it's a stretch? You think it's a stretch? And with regard to Iran, quick thought?
Oh, I think we're gearing up.
Yeah, I do too. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thanks, Ellen.
Thank you.
Always great talking with you. 57 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program, where smart people get their news. This is Air America Radio. Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
And welcome back to the third hour of our program. Tom Hartman here with you. TomHartman.com, AirAmerica.com for our blog. You can also find links there to our message board and also to our live chat room. You can drop in and say hi, hang out with the community. It is live every day while we're doing our program. In fact, it's live every day 24/7. A lot of people are using it for listening to other programs as well, so feel free to drop in. Matt Stoller is with us. He's a political activist and blogger in Washington, D.C. He was an editor at MyDD from November until 2005 until June of 2007. He's now with OpenLeft.com, a great progressive website. Matt, welcome to the program.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me.
You wrote a piece a week or so ago, Wednesday, August 22nd, I think it was, that caught my attention. I wanted to get you on and discuss it with you. And that's the idea of the Bush dog Democrats. That, you know, there's been a lot of talk. It used to be the yellow dog Democrats who were, you know, I don't want to harshly characterize them. Say what? Well, the Yellow Dog Democrats, my recollection is that the Yellow Dog Democrats were the kind of the remnants of the Southern racist bunch.
The Dixiecrats?
The Dixiecrats.
Oh man, now it's awkward.
Yeah, okay. Well, fill me in then. What do I have that's wrong here?
No, you're basically right. The Bush Dog Democrats are,
In the interim, we had the Blue Dog Democrats, and now you're talking about there's this whole new bunch, the Bush Dog Democrats.
Well, it's kind of a play on Blue Dog Democrats. I mean, one of the things that's going on right now is that Blue Dog Democrats are basically a remnant of the Southern conservative Democratic tradition, although they're not nearly as bad as it used to be in even the 80s. But they are.
Well, and the simple fact is, I think, you know, a lot of these people are simply representing their districts, which really is, you know, in a republic like we have, a democracy like we have, I mean, that's, we elect people to represent us. And so if somebody, you know, I have these conversations with members of Congress from time to time where I'll strongly disagree with them on an opinion, but if that's how their district wants them to vote, that's how I think they should vote.
I'm sorry, I'm not familiar. Are you aware of any districts where the war is popular and where wiretapping is, you know, people want the government to wiretap them?
No, the example I'm thinking of is a conversation that I had, you know, a year or so ago with Brian Baird about logging. And, you know, the district that he was from in Washington State, there was a broad consensus that they wanted a particular type of logging done. I mean, it was part of the industrial base of that district.
Uh-huh.
I was opposed to that. A lot of people, a lot of environmentalists were opposed to it. He voted for it because it's what the people elected him to do. I think that that's right in our form of government. I do agree with you, though, that I don't know of any districts. Maybe there are some. I don't know. Maybe some part of Wyoming or something, where people actually want the war?
Yeah, well, I mean, there are a few. There's some districts in Oklahoma. But if you, you know, let's talk about Brian Baird for a second. So he just got back from Iraq a week ago or something like that and said, well, you know, I voted against the war, but the surge is really working. And, you know, we reiterate some version of Tom Friedman's Pottery Barn Rule or Colin Powell's Pottery Barn Rule, which is that we're there now, and now we need to help the Iraqis and help them fix their country by staying there. And so he says that he's going to reverse his vote on timelines, and he's backing Bush's policies in Iraq. And
well, he hasn't said he's backing Bush's policies in Iraq. I've heard several people say that and paraphrase that, and that's not what he said. And in fact, he was on this program for an hour, not on this program, but on the local show that precedes this program that I'm on for an hour yesterday. And,
well,
you know, it was very
sorry,
clear.
Tom, but he's back in the surge. That's Bush's policies. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, I get that. I get that.
Well,
but he's also saying...
I don't think if I said that he said that he was backing Bush's policies, then, you know, I don't know if that quote is
I don't think he exactly quoted.
I'm not sure if I said that, but that's not what I meant. What I meant is he's backing Bush's policies. And there's no question that he went on to Tucker and talked about that. He's doing lots of interviews saying that we need to support the surge and back Bush's policy.
Yeah, rather than making this about Brian Baird, because because he's not here to defend himself, and I really think that if we're going to have any one person and we're going to go after them on what they're saying, let's make it a conversation rather than a bash fest or whatever. But there is this collection.
Wait a second here. I mean, wait a second. I'm not attacking Brian Baird. I'm just talking about the surge. He made public statements.
Sure.
And, he says that we need to stay in Iraq and fix Iraq. And I was going to bring up the fact that he went to a town hall meeting yesterday and got incredible amounts of pushback from his constituents and a variety of people, longtime people who have, allies of his, who have said that they would consider voting for someone else if they had an alternative, even though that they like him. And I think that's just reflective of the fact that a lot of the people who are supportive of the Bush administration policies, whether it's FISA, whether it's not being aggressive enough on contempt charges, or whether it's Iraq, are facing criticism and pressure from their constituents.
Yeah, no, I don't disagree with you on that. You know, broadly speaking, I wanted to be somewhat careful in parsing the words about specifically what Brian was saying, Congressman Baird was saying, because his position is relatively nuanced, and it is being portrayed both on the left and the right as
not
being nuanced.
No, it's not. That's just not true. His position is not nuanced. His position is, we need to support the surge. The surge is working. And he goes on and says, well, and we'll probably start withdrawals anyway because the military is already stretched. But it's not nuanced, and the left isn't taking him out of context. He's just wrong, and he's supporting Bush's policies.
Okay. So the larger issue here, you have identified in this piece, this whole collection of folks that you are calling the Bush dogs.
Right.
And that the I think the larger issue here, Matt, is that, you know, Congress has this horrible approval rating among the American people because there is this perception that they're not doing anything. And in large part, it's, in my opinion, it's because Congress, the Democrats in Congress are not operating like a party. Or they're not operating like a single party, you know, like the Republicans have historically, and you know, Mussolini's fascists did, you know, absolutely in lockstep behind, you know, their leader. Instead, they're acting like a coalition, and you've got all these various coalitions within the Democratic Party, and I think nationwide, Democrats are wrestling with the issue of how do we do something about this? What do we do? Is the job to move the Bushdog Democrats out to have primary challengers for them, for example, more liberal challengers? If so, in the more conservative districts, is that going to cause those districts to flip Republican? Or is it to get, you know, more progressives in other places, replace more Republicans with them? Or to somehow come to some sort of rapprochement with them?
Well, I mean, so the Bushdog Democrats is a campaign not about primarying conservative Democrats. It's a campaign to criticize Democrats that vote against core values of progressives. So, you know, FISA would be a core, the ability for Bush to just wiretap whoever he wants,
sure,
whenever he wants without a court order. It's a core,
sure,
value of progressives. It's a core American value. You vote against that, it's not popular, you're not voting your district, you're just wrong. That's it. As for the strategic kind of question of whether there should be primary challengers or, you know, whether the district is vulnerable or et cetera, you know, I guess what I would say to that is that's a lot of that's up to local activists, and in terms of strategic questions, there's really no evidence that that primary challenges from progressives weaken Democrats in conservative districts or swing districts. And even the definition of a swing district is, you know, we're still operating on a 2000 and 2002, 2004 model of what a swing district is, and the country has moved quite dramatically. So going into a conversation premised on strategic ideas that I think are outdated or strategic assumptions that are outdated,
yeah,
is not something that is...
We have about a half a minute left. How do we go beyond just criticizing people?
Well,
how do we
mean,
move them forward?
Well, Brian Baird got huge pushback from his at his town hall.
Sure.
You know, and the
and
first
I'm sure
step
he'll
is,
get it tonight. He's doing another one as well.
Right. I mean, the first.
But at least he's out there doing them. You know, half the members of Congress don't even do these town halls.
That's not true. A lot of them are doing these town halls. I don't really know why. I mean, I don't really know Brian Baird. I know he was just he's just been sort of a foolish on a few core issues like Terri Schiavo. But it's just the point is, the guy seems like he seems like a good guy, and you know he might, you know, I don't know. Maybe he's good for his district. I'm not sure. I'm not voting for him. But the point is that you start by identifying these people, talking about them, and figuring out who they are, and then letting activists know that they can be challenged and that they can be questioned. And from
and,
then,
and
you
then
know,
and then question them. Yeah. Oh. Matt, we're out of time. Thanks for being with us, and thanks for the great work you're doing.
Thanks
over
a lot.
Over at OpenLeft.com. 16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
It's all going to work out. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Sometimes things just get downright crazy, you know? Just downright crazy. A man who authorities say used his computer to make fake U.S. $100 bills got busted. Why? Because he went to the Deja Vu Club in Nashville and gave them to strippers. $600 worth of phony $100 bills. They turned him into the Secret Service. So there's a moral. There's probably several morals in that story. I guess we'll leave that for the next person who has a good understanding of those of you know where morals and stories and whatnot go. I had an email here. I'll get back to it in just a second. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Ron in Santa Clara, California. Hey, Ron, what's on your mind?
Well, hi, Tom. I really love your show. I'm really concerned about our country to a point that you just probably wouldn't recognize me from 10 years ago. I've been writing and I've been calling and I've been trying to prevent what's going on. And I'm concerned that the people through the Patriot Act and the disassociation with our non-feeling and sharing that we go on through with every day, that we're just not going to get together and stop these people. How can we stop this war if they start this war with Iran, how are we going to stop this? Our representatives are not actually listening to us. They didn't hear us, apparently, when we had election last year.
Yeah, well, I think, as I've said several times over the last couple of weeks, I have a feeling that they're getting a huge earful in their town hall meetings all over the United States right now, and that we're going to see some changes this fall. On the other hand, I do not underestimate, I don't think any of us should underestimate, the power of the dark side, the power of war and fear, the politics of fear that the Bush administration has practiced, that has been absolutely embraced right across the board by the Republican Party, because they know it's the only way that they can hold power, because their economic policies are not what the people of the United States want. Their domestic policies are not what the people of the United States want. The people of the United States want a national health care system, not you know, a broken privatized system. They want good jobs. They want the right to join a union. They want clean air and clean water. They, you know, right across the board, Republican policies over and over and over again exclusively benefit millionaires and billionaires, and that's it. And as long, the only way that Republicans can keep us from knowing that, figuring that out, and being focused on that is to keep us at war. They've got that one down. They've got that one figured out. And that's my big concern, is that Iran is going to come along next. And in that context, I share your concern that the politics of fear are going to trump everything else. And in that regard, what we need to be saying to each other is, I am not afraid. I am not afraid. It's, I agree with Franklin Roosevelt.
Let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror, which paralyzes needed efforts to convert retreat into advance.
And that's the thing. We need to be looking forward at advance. And we need to say, we're not afraid. And we need to say to our elected officials, don't be afraid. We got your backside. We're with you. Or we've got your back. It's a poor choice of words, especially after the Larry Craig story. Anyhow, we're with you. We're here standing side by side with you. We're gonna make it work with you. This is really important. I really believe we need to go beyond just kicking people's butts and saying, damn it, you didn't vote the right way. We really need to go the next step and say, we're going to participate. We're going to be here for you. We're going to, and to a certain extent, that means even doing things like joining the local Democratic Party, joining the local Green Party, even joining the Republican Party if you're inclined, getting out there and getting active. Mark in San Francisco. Hey, Mark.
Hey, thanks for taking my Tom call. I love your show. Tom. Anyway, I'm calling because just such an organization is taking shape here in Northern California behind an author by the name of Joel Wendt, who's written a pamphlet called Uncommon Sense. And if you Google his name, you'll find it. It basically is a call to something called citizen governance. And the citizen governance movement is a movement that is involving people in the day-to-day local activities, not just politics, but the running of our society. The civil defense movement in the 50s and the 40s was one thing, but this is something else. And it's basically a device to teach people how to empower themselves at the local level beyond the traditional grassroots canvassing and sort of protest methodology that we were stuck with after the 60s. It's now time to take the reins of our country, but not in a violent way or in a way that's destructive or divisive. We need to create common bonds amidst conservatives and progressives.
Yeah, very, very well said, Mark. Mark, we're up against the clock, but good point and well made. And I would say that Howard Dean's brother is doing the same thing out there with democracyforamerica.com. democracyforamerica.com, a great organization doing much the same. 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Sign up your name.
Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. I got to tell you, this is a real story, a true story. I got an email. It was a CC of an email that somebody by the name of Sven, I don't know if he wants his last name out here, sent to George Bush. And he says, Dear Mr. Bush, as a concerned citizen, I feel I should warn you about tonight's coming eclipse. The lunar eclipse starts as the moon enters the Earth's penumbra at 3:54 a.m., you know, an hour later, the blah, 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 blah. Because of this astrological event, as an astrologer, I feel you should cancel all trips and or public engagements today and tomorrow. The planet Saturn is in conjunction with Regulus at this time. Jupiter can, and he goes through all this, these details. He says, these are all bad omens. For these and other reasons, I feel you would not be wise to travel or to make any public appearances under these bad transits. For example, I certainly wouldn't go duck hunting with Dick Cheney. And then he says, you know, I have no legal knowledge of this. This isn't a threat. This is just, you know, I'm concerned. Okay, so I get this copy of this thing. The next day, this story appears in Reuters. A New Mexico new motorcycle officer crashed and died on Monday, that'd be yesterday, while escorting U.S. President George W. Bush in his motorcade from a political fundraiser back to the airport, the White House said. Totally strange. Totally strange. Anyhow, so that's our Twilight Zone alert for the day. 1-866-303-2270, our number. Roberta in San Diego, California, listening on KLSD. Hey, Roberta.
Hi, how are you doing this morning?
I'm fine. But KLSD is a bit up in the air, I understand.
Well, we're having major challenges, and you know, the community is pulling together and doing everything we can. You probably already know that. We had a big rally yesterday morning, and I think there were about 500 people that showed up in front of the radio station and stayed for a few hours. But, you know, it's just sometimes very, it's beyond frustrating. It just feels like there's this oppression and repression, you know, like like we're under this siege of some kind, and we just have to fight so hard.
Well, on the website for KLSD, I put in a call yesterday to a couple of people there and haven't heard back from anybody, but actually over the last several days I've made a couple of calls. But the bottom line, and over on their website, they say, you know, it was a great thing and, you know, thank you for showing up and that kind of thing. And I know Stacy has, you know, been doing this on his local show, but the point that I haven't heard anybody make and that I think, you know, I may be wrong, but I really think is the basis of this whole thing is that it's a business. And yep. if folks in San Diego want to support KLSD, they need to be doing the same thing that, frankly, we have, you know, from time to time, folks here in Portland who do this with KPOJ. They'll find somebody who should be an advertiser and call up the station ad department and say, you know, I think these people should advertise with you, and here's a lead. You know, bring business into the radio station, and you're going to have an absolutely bulletproof radio station. If you don't bring business into the radio station, it's going to face challenges. And because there, you know, there's a long history of progressive radio stations that, in part because of the blacklist, and it's not just a blacklist of progressive talk radio. There's one for conservatives as well. But in part because of that, in part because some companies don't want to get involved in what they consider controversy or whatever. There are stations that have great ratings, but haven't always translated that into money. And it's up to us. On the other hand, you've got stations. I mean, there's some incredible advertisers. You're getting spectacular, you know, the Asteroid Cafe up in Seattle, Mad Woman Bakery in Minneapolis, Tom Dwyer Automotive here in Portland. I mean, there are advertisers who are getting incredible results advertising locally on progressive radio stations. And what hopefully it's not too late. What I would encourage people listening to KLSD in San Diego to do is find those potential progressive advertisers or even mainstream advertisers who are willing to advertise on a progressive radio station and put them in touch with the salespeople over at KLSD. That would be step one in my mind. And I'm saying this based on absolutely no conversations I've had whatsoever with anybody at the radio station, because mm-hmm. I haven't had an opportunity to talk with anybody there over the last couple of days.
Well, there was a flyer with some facts on it, the structural imbalance of political talk radio, which, you know, gives some, you know, statistics here. Each weekday, 2,570 hours and 15 minutes of conservative talk are broadcast on these stations compared to 254 hours of progressive talk, 10 times as much conservative talk as progressive talk. I mean, I could go on.
You know, I understand all that, Roberta, and we've talked about that on the program, but the fact of the matter is that 15 years ago, when conservative talk radio was starting out, They were saying the same thing. Mm. You know, there's all this sports programming, there's all this women's programming, there's all this music, and nobody is talking about conservative, you know. And it took a couple of years for conservative talk radio to reach the point where the weak shows had shaken out and the stronger shows had taken over, and a business evolutionary, and the business community had realized that it was not only not a dangerous thing to advertise on conservative talk radio, but it actually could be profitable. And in a lot of markets, that's what's happening right now with progressive talk radio, is that people are figuring out, hey, this is something that works. This is a financial and business model that works. And I started in radio in 1968. I've been a DJ. I was a DJ for 3 years. I did news for 7 years. I was a program director for a year. I've been in every, and I've been a nationally syndicated talk show host for 5 years. And I've been in every end of this business. And I really believe that what's going on with progressive talk radio right now is it's going through that same evolutionary process that conservative talk radio was going through 15 years ago. It's facing many of the same challenges that conservative talk radio did back then, and that we are going to come out on the other side. We're going to lose a few stations in the way. We're going to gain a few. I mean, this show's picked up 3 affiliates just in the last couple of months. But the number one way, I have to tell you, the number one way to support a radio station, whether it's your local progressive station that you're trying to support, or whether it's, you know, the local rock and roll station that you listen, I mean, whatever it may be, is to patronize their advertisers and let them know, number one, let the advertisers know that you support give them results. And number two, help the radio station bring new advertisers in. Mm-hmm. And then those numbers are going to turn around. It's going to take a while. There's a herd mentality in this business. Nobody ever got fired for at least in the last 10 years, nobody ever got fired as a program director for putting Rush Limbaugh or Michael Savage or Sean Hannity on the air. Nobody can say with absolute certainty that that's the case about progressive talk radio, and everybody's risk averse. Nobody wants to lose their job. Everybody is trying to be very, very careful. And what we have to do is show the incredible successes we've had. I mean, I beat Rush Limbaugh in the ratings in more than one market repeatedly. Progressive talk radio, and I've been going up against him for years. Progressive talk radio works in those markets where radio stations promote it and where the listeners are out there promoting it and where you can get the advertisers. It just has to ultimately turn into a business. It has to become a business. And it is becoming a business in many, I'd say probably most of our affiliates. And there's a few it's really still a challenge, still a struggle. So, Roberta, you know, stay with it. And I thought the demonstration yesterday was a wonderful thing. And try to, you know, assuming that it's not too late, do what you can to find progressive advertisers out there and get them involved. Roberta, I've got to move along, but thank you for your call. Thanks for supporting KLSD. It's a great station, and there's some wonderful people down there. I've been there. I've done my show from there. I did an event down there last fall, whenever it was, about 6-8 months ago. And Stacy is great, and Cliff is great, and there's just some great people. Lawrence in San Francisco. Hey, Lawrence, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. How you doing? I wanted to pick up on the guy talking about organizing, community organizing in Northern California, because we are doing it in Berkeley as well. I just want to say this, that whenever progressives organize, whether it's for peace, for ecology, for health care, whatever, you've also got to organize communities and keep the communities going. And so we're having a peace rally in Berkeley on Saturday, September 15th, which is going to be different. Because at this peace rally, yeah, we're going to have speeches, we'll have Dan Ellsberg, but we're also asking people to join workshops and discussion and action circles that will be talking about how to organize demonstrations, how to do research and publicity, talking to the military and veterans, organizing on campus, and also neighborhood food and gardens, sustainable.
That's great stuff, Lawrence. Now, what you're calling to tell me about is essentially a local event, right?
It is, but
how do we make that a national event? How can other communities replicate what you're doing? Is there a website or anything like that out there?
Not yet. You know, I'm sure, you know, eventually we will. But the key is that when you have a demonstration, you can't simply have speeches and talk to people as though you were a television announcer. You have to organize people so that when they come to events, they come in groups of ones and twos, and they don't leave in groups of ones and twos. They leave with new friends and new jobs to do and new communities.
Right, creating dialogue.
Exactly, creating dialogue and creating permanent communities. You know, so yeah. The ideal situation is that when you come to a meeting, everybody leaves with a new affinity group, and they will continue working in that new affinity group. And,
well said. Lawrence, you want to just plug the local thing real quick?
Yeah, it's going to be Saturday, September 15th. In People's Park in Berkeley, famous People's Park, yeah. 1 to 5.
Yeah,
and I'll give my phone number if anyone wants to call me, because we're looking for people that will help organize and help facilitate all these various workshops.
Okay, you sure you want to put your phone number out on national radio?
Sure, I'll talk to anybody. It's 510, that's in Berkeley, 510-540-1975. 540-1975, the year the Vietnam War ended. And, yeah, call me. I'd love to talk about it, especially if you're local and you want to help with one of these workshops. But otherwise, I have a slogan for demonstrations or meetings. The meeting is not over until everybody leaves with a job to do and somebody to do it with.
Yeah, very well said. Lawrence, thank you very much for sharing that. And good luck with it. And I would say the lesson for all of us is that all across the country, we need to be doing what Lawrence is doing. This is not just a local story. This and it's so true. And it's like I said, this is what Jim Dean, Howard Dean's brother, with Democracy for America, is one of the things that they're teaching, and they're teaching very effectively in democracyforamerica.com. And frankly, I don't know of any. Well, there's several other groups that are as well. 45 minutes past the hour.
Truth in broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Took it down, climbed a mountain and I turned around, and I saw my reflection in the snow-covered hills, till the landslide brought me down. Oh, mirror in the sky, what is love? Can the child in my heart rise above, and can I sail through the changing ocean tides? Can I handle the seasons?
9.5 minutes before the hour. Prabhata in San Francisco, California, listening on the Quake.
Hi,
hey,
Tom.
Prabhata.
Great show. Thank you. I just want to make the point, you know, regarding the FDA and the testing of food for imports. I used to work for a company here in San Francisco, very good label. I won't say the name. But we used to test, I remember, our food to make sure that everything that went on the shelf was safe to consume. Mm-hmm. And what I'm trying to get at is that the FDA cannot really, in my opinion, test to a level for safety, they just can't. The industry.
You mean the USDA, the U.S. Department of Agriculture? I agree with you. I absolutely agree with you. And any company that's in it for the long term and that is really reputable is going to respond to those market forces and is going to try and do it. On the other hand, I'll tell you, back in the early 1970s, I was a partner in a company that was manufacturing herbal teas. And at the time, the state of Pennsylvania had the highest standards in the country. And so everybody had to meet Pennsylvania Department of Agriculture regulations. In fact, you'd very often, back in the 70s and 80s, see on a label, you know, conforms to Pennsylvania Department of Agriculture. And that meant that we had to have certain levels of sterility. We had to have certain levels of a lineage of the individual herbs that went into our teas. We had to demonstrate or be able to demonstrate that all this stuff was real. And we actually had to apply to Pennsylvania for certification, even though we were in Michigan at the time, in order to get that, as well as the Michigan Department of Health. If we were going to try to create a fly-by-night organization that was only going to operate for 6 months or a year and was going to pump a product really hard, make a ton of money and run, that would have prevented us from doing that. And that's where the potential harm comes.
Well, the thing is that the FDA can definitely has a role. I'm not saying that, you know, I'm definitely a liberal. What I'm saying is it is up to the industry. Like Mattel, people keep looking to the, you know, China and saying it's their, you know, their problem. No, it was Mattel. They should have tested the toys that they imported. And they should have never gone on the shelf.
Again, because Mattel's in it for the long haul. I mean, they're very concerned about their reputation, which has taken a huge hit. But I guarantee you that there's a lot of no-name toy companies out there whose products are probably still on the market and still full of lead that people are buying because it's the cheapest stuff that they can get in their local, you know, cheap big box retailer. And that is not being regulated, and that should be the place where the U.S. Department of Agriculture should be testing, you know, particularly things like toys and children's bibs and food and things.
And that's where I disagree with you. I don't think, you know, that it should be the FDA doing the testing, but saying to all the importers, you import, you make sure that what you're going to put on the shelves is safe. And so we have to throw the responsibility back to the importer. And I don't care how small they are. I mean, we can always
hire. And just like with the Superfund sites, you say to the importers, you're going to have to make sure that this testing happens. And by the way, we're going to provide that standardized testing.
Yeah.
We're not going to do it at a profit. We're going to do it. This is going to be a people's agency. It's the United States Department of Agriculture. We're going to charge you a fee for that testing that covers the cost of the test.
Yeah.
But we're going to do the test so that we know that it's standardized. We know that it's done the way it should be done, as opposed to another fly-by-night private corporation that sets itself up as a testing agency just to be a sham testing agency.
That is true, but we can also, you know, I mean, there's so many ways to regulate. I mean, we can even have the testing done by the company themselves and simply give the results of those tests.
Yeah, see, and that...
And have approved agencies. Right now we have approved agencies to do so many, you know, businesses.
Yeah. No, I got it. Prabhata, I got your point, and I think that we've trounced this discussion to death. Let's move along. Buck in San Clemente, California. Hey, Buck.
Hey, Tom. I love your show, and it's you're a breath of fresh air, and you've really educated me a lot, but I just wanted to get that out of the way.
Thank you. I'm
in San Clemente.
Not necessary, by the way.
Huh?
Not necessary, by the way, but thank you.
Okay. I'm sorry. I'm in San Clemente. I'm like in between LA and KLSD, and they both come in really fuzzy. So just lately I've been listening to you off the cable TV, which is, I don't know if it's Sirius or what, but it's nice to have you there.
CRN, Cable Radio Network. Curious.
Yeah, it'd be cool if you were like Wolfman Jack. You know, it's not really American, but to set up in Mexico somewhere with a gazillion kilowatts and broadcast to the whole, you know, from Northern California.
This is what we need, is one of these shortwave channels or something.
Well, I mean,
but anyway, we've got a half a minute before the show is all over today here, Buck. Is there a point you
want
to make?
I just want the Attorney General, Ted Olson, is going to be Bush's man because he... Sorry, my dog's out here. But
okay.
He has done everything Bush has wanted, you know, and he...
Oh, and he was the hitman against Clinton, you know, during the Clinton administration.
Exactly, but his wife was also, and... She's now
she's now dead.
A martyr,
right.
9/11 martyr. And believe me, that is going to they think they're going to push that through the 08 elections.
Yeah.
And you
Yeah, no, I think you got it, Buck. And Ted Olson, well, we'll see. But Ted Olson would be a tough one not to get through Congress. Tomorrow, Court Bloomquist and I are going to be talking about the difference between private and government Wi-Fi networks. Michael Crowley here about how Uncle Sam cuts checks for hemorrhoid sufferers while vets can't get their benefits. And our Everything You Know Is Wrong segment, Jonathan Mooney dropping by for a journey beyond normal. Don't forget, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.